Greetings, constant listeners. It's your boy, Michael Monroeville Mall Rothman. Now, you're probably wondering, Mike, what's up? Why aren't we on the mile? Well, look, we're bumping things back a bit, so expect to hear our full dissection of Frank Darabont's The Green Mile next week. But here's the good news. What you're about to hear is our four-part rewatch of Mick Garris's The Stand, which we recorded way, way back in April and May. You know, when the pandemic just started and we had no clue what was in store for us. Here's the thing, though. While we shared the first part with you, the three other chapters were exclusive to the Barons, our Patreon page. Now, in anticipation of CBS All Access's new miniseries, The Stand, and really because this is the season of giving, we've decided to unlock all four just for you. My Life for You? Yes, our four-part miniseries just for you. Consider it an extra long sweet treat that'll keep you entertained for a few long days and maybe even a few pleasant nights. Happy holidays. And please, for the love of God, wear a mask.
Consequence Podcast Network.
My friendship to all of you precludes my involvement with any one of you. But if you want to make love, then I do too, and I'll be right there behind you.
Welcome yet again to the Losers Club, a Stephen King podcast. My name is Rockin' Randall Colburn, and today we are here to discuss part three of the 1994 Stand miniseries. We've been in the midst of a great rewatch to honor and celebrate the current pandemic. Is that a way to put it?
Yeah, honor. What a pleasant way to
celebrate.
Yeah, yeah. Sure. So, just kidding. No, we're all losing our minds, and we figured, what better way to deal with our minds being lost than to watch a 6.5-hour epic about a devastating flu that kills off 99% of the population. So let's go around and introduce ourselves. Mike, why don't you start?
Well, I'm Michael Miguel Ferrer Rothman. It's funny you mentioned that we're celebrating the pandemic and watching The Stand. And my interview with Joe Bob Briggs this week, he thinks people are absolutely crazy to be reading The Stand and watching The Stand. We were saying how everyone's sadists, if you will. So I guess we're sadists. We're sitting here watching his very movie. So
he's in it.
So he's the star.
Did he say anything else about The Stand?
No. We just talked about, I just asked if he's, you know, the fact that he like read the book and also lived in it, but being the movie, if he saw any sort of, you know, parallels to, you know, in the book and what's going on right now. And he's just like, no, and I have no interest in going back to it. And I don't know why anyone else is right now. And it got us into pandemic and contagion movies. And then he slammed Contagion also, which is pretty great. I love him, but,
If you want to, if you do want to hear him talk about The Stand, revisit our interview with him from last year. Correct.
It's true. Yeah. He went in. He talked about how Stephen King on the set, on the set, they had a phone and a briefcase that dialed up to Stephen King, which is pretty funny.
So. And didn't he have like a death scene in the movie that they
cut? Did? Yeah. And if you look online, you can find a makeup test with where he has the tube neck. So.
Mac, why don't you introduce yourself?
This is Mackenzie, or Mac, as Randall likes to call me, Wildcard Gerber, and I am a constant contributor to this podcast, as well as Halloweenies, and I'm very excited to talk about part three, The Betrayal.
The Betrayal.
Love the name. This one was, I remember when I said that I wasn't going to be on the second episode, but I'll be on three, and I was thinking three was not this one. So I was really excited watching this this entry and raring to talk about it.
And who is joining us from Nashville? Who is this?
Hey, this is Jen, a real wowzer Adams. and I'm a co-host of the Horror Virgin podcast and contributor to the Losers Club now, I guess.
Yeah, we love having you around.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm so excited. And I love, love, love The Stand. And this is my favorite part of the book, and interested to talk about how it translates to TV. You know, because not everything is fantastic.
No. Yeah. Let's, I would love to hear
a
little
bit. What are
you
talking about?
We've kind of been going around talking about how we first encountered The Stand and The Stand miniseries. So we'd love to hear that from you as well.
Yeah. So I have said in the past that this was my first experience with Stephen King, but that can't be true because it came out in 94. And in 94, I was in eighth grade. And I have these memories of being in like fifth or sixth grade and like trying to like beg people to watch like Children of the Corn and Pet Sematary at slumber parties, and like reading stories from Night Shift when I spent the night with friends. So that was the kid that I was. But I have these memories of going into eighth grade and talking about this show. It was almost like a water cooler kind of thing in my little middle school, but it can't have been the first thing that I encountered with Stephen King, but I think it's what really made me fall in love with Stephen King, because I read this book. I still have the copy that I read, and it's like falling apart even with all the tape that I've put on it to keep it together.
Nice.
And I just, after this, like I couldn't get enough, and I started reading everything I could get my hands on.
That's cool. And wait, remind me, did you say you read it first or you saw this first?
I saw this first, yeah. And then I read it. Yes. But it had been on my dad's bookshelf for like a while, and I kind of just looked at it like really fascinated by it. And then I was like, oh, that's what this is. I love this.
Yeah. Were your parents supportive of you reading it at that age?
They kind of were. Yeah. I think in fifth and sixth grade, they were not so cool with it. But then once I was in like seventh and eighth, a lot of my friends were already reading that kind of stuff. They were like, yeah, whatever. Plus, my dad already had them. So I would just like sneak them down and read them in my bedroom when they didn't notice they were gone from the shelf. So,
right.
You know.
Well, great. Well, this is Randall Disco Queen Colburn. I'm going to not be rocking. I'm disco straight for this
episode.
Unprecedented.
Lots of Herald intros.
You're strutting.
Well, Harold's one of my, him and Bowers are my two favorite characters in the entire King canon. So it's, and this is a big Harold episode. So what happens in this episode? I guess I'll just do a quick rundown. Basically, everyone arrives in Boulder. The Boulder Free Zone Committee starts up. They start to rebuild. Are you laughing?
I am.
I think I know why, but we'll get to that in a minute. Basically, the communities start to develop both in Boulder and in Las Vegas, but there's a couple interlopers, including Harold Lauder and Nadine Cross, who are not quite on the same wavelength as Mother Abigail, but they are there and planning a sabotage that culminates in a bomb planted during a Boulder Free Zone Committee meeting that kills our beloved Nick Andros, played by ultimate hunk Rob Lowe. And then also we get some action in Vegas with the Trash Can Man showing up. He's building bombs and stuff. And then what else does Randall Flagg do in the third part? Why am I blanking?
He's hanging around.
Oh, he creeps on Nadine a lot.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's like a bunch of like dreams and flashbacks with that. And so ends with Mother Abigail basically going off on a vision quest, coming back emaciated and dying before sending off Stu, Glenn, Ralph, and Larry to Vegas to travel on foot like it was the Bible or something.
Yeah.
And to put an end
to make a stand.
To make a stand. Yeah. And so that's what we're going to be discussing. And so, yeah, this is the part of the book that I think when, if you go back and listen to our stand episodes, we struggled with this part because you spend a lot of time basically going back and forth between Boulder Free Zone transcripts from the various meetings they've been having, and then everyone ending with Franny and Stu banging in some way, shape, or form, and them saying really cheesy lines to each other that we love to quote. Yeah. But Jen, so you are a fan of this section of the book. We would love to hear your thoughts on it.
Yeah, this is my favorite section of the book. And I think, like, to try to explain it, let's take us to the fourth season of Arrested Development.
Okay.
And I was so excited for this season because I love the first three. And I was watching it and I was like, get the damn cast together, because everybody was on their own little adventures, and it wasn't as exciting. And so this is the section where all of these characters that we've like fallen in love with are finally interacting. And that's why I like it so much. I think it's also kind of a return to normalcy and like, a lot of the things we've been talking about and planning are actually starting to come together. And I know you guys don't like the meeting notes. And I will admit, maybe we could have had one less meeting in the book than we do. Yeah. But I just love like seeing them all interact with each other, you know. And I think like the fact that they cut the meeting so short actually like makes a lot of what comes next seem like real clunky and forced, yeah. You know? So I think they actually could have like spaced this out a little bit, you know? But yeah, this is like one of my favorite sections. Like, and we get the Franny and Stu, which was like growing up. That's what I thought like love was. And it's like, oh, they're so romantic. And Gary Sinise is so dreamy. So like, I loved watching all of this stuff. And I love Harold as well. Although my thoughts about him have kind of changed over the past year. But, yeah, we just get to see all this exciting stuff, and nobody is really, like, except for the bomb, everybody's pretty happy, and I kind of like that, you know?
Yeah.
That's true.
And we do get to see sort of, I know what you mean, there is this sense of getting the band together, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because, mm-hmm. and that's part of the fun of, you know, when you get, like, Nick and Tom and Ralph linking up on the road, or, you know, Larry and Nadine and stuff like that. That is part of the joy, mm-hmm. is watching the characters collide together once we get there. And yeah, you're right. I actually was thinking about that while I was watching it. I was like, we never really get a scene where, like, we get like a couple scenes where people meet, but like, you know, when Stu and all of them show up, like in the background, you see like Nick and Stu shake hands, you know? And it's mm-hmm. like, mm-hmm. and it's like, I don't know. You wish that there was something a little more there that actually showed a developing relationship. But so you said your thoughts changed on Harold in the last year. I'd love to hear you talk about that.
So I love, like you love Harold too. I love him. And I always thought he was the most like intriguing character. And partly when I was little, I had a big crush on Parker Lewis from Parker Lewis Campus.
Yes.
So I was like, yes, Corin Nemec is in this. And I was really excited. But I thought his storyline was really like, he's got a really intriguing arc. And I think it's one a lot of people can relate to, of just being feeling like insecure and not like ever feeling like you fit in. And so I have actually wrote like a rough draft of an essay a while ago about how like Harold is the biggest tragedy in The Stand. Mm. And I think there's still a lot of validity to that. But over the past year, and partly because I've been going to a lot of therapy, I realized like a lot of those ideas were formed from just growing up with a lot of really toxic men and boys.
Interesting.
Because like Harold is an incel.
Yes, he is.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, and so now I'm looking at him and I'm like, no, I don't want to pity you, because like what I thought was such a tragedy was that he couldn't ever see his value, mm-hmm. and he left Boulder. And this is getting into a little ahead, but like he could, like his suicide note is just so sad, because he could have been something in Boulder. And this is when we see the seeds of that. He just can't see it. And he's so easily swayed. And I think that's what's the tragedy. But like, all of that is within his power. And right. I think that's what frustrates me so much.
Yeah, you know, that's a great point. And that is something I feel like we touched on in the episode. I'm sure I did, because I love that character, precisely mm-hmm. because of a lot of what you're saying, which is that he could be of great value there, especially in the book. They really get into how he was a really vital member of the, like, he was doing mm-hmm. a lot of the hard work. He had a lot of good ideas, and he was, you know, willing to be a workhorse. And there is this really wonderful moment where he goes on like a bike ride, like on a motorcycle, and he's driving yeah. through the neighborhood. Yeah. Do you remember that, Mike? And like mm-hmm. he basically has this moment where he makes that decision. He's like, I could actually settle in here. Like yeah. I could build a life here, and I could be valued here. But that's the thing, is that it's not that he can't see his value, because he can. It's that he chooses, because he's so filled with his ego and his resentment is what uh-huh. he lets win, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he just can't let it go.
Right, he's
yeah.
so mad at Stu. He's so fucked up about Franny, and just feels slighted in every way by mm-hmm. all these people, because he doesn't feel like... Like, he knows he can provide value, but he doesn't feel like they value him enough. And he just wants people basically to worship him. And that's the thing mm-hmm. with a lot of incels. Like, and this is a little dark, but I promise I won't dwell on it. But it's like, I always remember Elliot Roger, who was the incel who shot up the sorority some years ago. He, in videos that he would make, would always talk about what an amazing guy he was, and how he was this, like, testament to masculinity and all these other things. And he's like, I don't understand why women don't like me, because I'm such a perfect human being, you know? And it's so fucked up, but it's like, that is the mindset of a lot of incels, which is that, is they have no self-awareness. They're, you know, so blinded by their own resentment and their own self-aggrandizing, like, egos, that they can't recognize, humility in any way, shape or form. And then of course there's the whole narcissistic aspect to it, which is that, you know, they can't develop empathy for other people or actually view things from different perspectives. And so, so that's what I think I've always really liked about Harold, was that it's like, he is this really interesting figure, and there is a tragedy to him, but it's also one of his own doing. You know, it's not like it's like, whereas Nadine, I think, is a more tragic figure, because the problem in the book and in the miniseries, and I want to talk about it, is that it feels like she doesn't get a chance.
She never does. Yeah. No, yeah, that's my like biggest issue.
She's doomed, whereas Harold had a choice, you know? And that's sort of, I think, a really fast... I feel like in the book it's a little more nuanced, but in the series especially, and we'll talk more about it later, but I think Nadine has done so dirty. Like, I can't even get past it. And so it's interesting stuff. But let's talk about maybe... Before we get into all that stuff, let's talk about maybe some scenes that we liked in this part. Like, what stands out to you as something that worked in this part? Mike, why don't you start?
Well, I mean, one of my favorite aspects of the book, because I have a really love-hate relationship, mostly hate with this section of the book, just because I feel like it starts getting a little egregious with regards to character arcs. Like you mentioned Nadine. Nadine is one of the probably the worst arcs of this book, if only because you're right. She never gets a chance, and she definitely doesn't get a chance in this show and the miniseries. And they kind of... Harold kind of falls into that pitfall too, because they're like, well, these are the two outcasts, so we're just going to go in there. And they give a little nuance to Harold, because then you kind of see him working a little bit on the crew, especially with like picking up the bodies, the cordwood. You know, for the most part, like it is so, you know, blasé. But what I do love about this section of the book is when Glenn kind of goes off and talks about the philosophy of society and gets into some of the more anthropological discussions about just the construction of society and like what's damned society in the past. And we get a really great scene that's actually at the amphitheater that they discuss in the book, or that they said it in the, or King said it in the book. And it's a really great moment. And it's the only moment I would argue in this entire chapter that kind of distracts or dissuades from the fact that everything else seems so assuredly Christian and religious, because it's the one time where he's actually like kind of challenging the, like the tenets of God in scripture and you know, the fallacies that religion imposes upon society, which is all stuff that King gets into it in epic depth in the book, which is one of the reasons why I love that section so much. And I love watching Ray Walston deliver these lines and these diatribes, and just the way it kind of kicks off this section is really great. And like I, you know, we talked about how we should have more meeting minutes in this this section, and Jen did. I think we could have used like one more with Glenn, but I know a lot of people aren't fans of when he goes and rambles, but that was always my favorite.
I love that
thing.
Stuff.
Yeah. I do too. Yeah.
So I love
Mac,
that part.
Mac, what about you? What did you enjoy?
You know, I was trying to think why I enjoyed this series so much when I first watched it when I was a kid. And I do agree with Jen a little bit in this sense that in this chapter of the miniseries, I think I was really excited to see everybody together. It threw me off a little bit. I remember because we were recording this on VHS back in the day, you know, when it was on live. And uh-huh. I remember starting this and thinking, oh God, we missed something. We recorded the wrong thing or didn't pick up the first like 30 minutes. Cause it just starts with that surgery. And there was like random people there that have not been on the show yet. And it was really confusing. But I agree in the sense that, you know, we do get these sequences with everybody. Like I remember like things that stand out to me are yes, the meeting with the bomb, the ad hoc committee, obviously, I actually like that scene. It's probably because it's so short. it's like breath of fresh air compared to the book. And they kind of just cut it out. But it's fun to see everybody kind of playing off each other. And I think it's also, and I think you might have mentioned this the first time around, Randall, but I think Larry's got a lot to do in this section of the miniseries.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you kind of see him... turn around a little bit. Like, there's more to him in this, and I don't know if it's because he's with Lucy now or whatever, but like, I thought that was kind of interesting. I don't know. I'd have to reach, though. All the Nadine and Harold stuff, I don't really like. It's a slog to get through that stuff in this version.
Hey, we're talking about happy things right now.
I know. But if we're talking about happy things, then I love the Cordwood sequence. Love Cordwood. shout out to Dan Caffrey.
That stuff is to me like my favorite as well. Is the moments like when they're cleaning up the dead bodies and also the scene with Glenn and Stu and Ralph where they're talking about and Nick, and they're talking about sort of the larger implications of you know, the society that they built and what Mother Abigail represents within that. That stuff is all super interesting to me, and of course that's the stuff that's kind of, you know, most reverent to King's text, I think, which says a lot. So
yeah.
Jen, how about you? What is some stuff that stands out to you as good?
Well, I love the Stu and Franny finally getting together, although it was really, we're talking about good stuff.
Yeah.
The meeting, like the big meeting, is probably my favorite part of this episode. And I'm not going to lie, I cried a little bit when they were singing the national anthem.
Aww.
And I think that's probably because of like where we are right now and like my mental state. And I think there's just something so powerful about like lots of people singing together. I think that's a really like powerful uniting thing, and nobody's really trying to like be like this diva. They're all just kind of singing with this authentic voice, and like I made me start thinking about like when I'm gonna be in a situation like that again.
Yeah.
You know, because we've been shut down for like a month or two months at this point, and like it was just like to see them like celebrate getting back on their feet again, I think kind of reminded me of where we are right now as a country, and also like made me nostalgic for those kind of things that I think we take for granted.
Yeah. And I think that's a really interesting point. And it's something that I actually want to use that meeting as sort of a jumping off point, because, and Mike, you touched on this too, which is the Christian idea, the sort of like, it's the idea of like an inherent goodness and an inherent badness, which mm-hmm. is something that I think mm-hmm. King complicates in the book. And we talked about this a bit in the part two episode, but just the idea of like creating a functioning democracy versus creating like a totalitarian state, and how you know, from the outsider, like, you know, you can, Randall Flagg can say, you know, our town has no crime, it has no drugs, it has no anything, like we are a functioning society and everything, but that's because he kills people who do anything, you know, whereas in a democracy, mm-hmm. You're putting more power to the people, and so things are going to be maybe a little sloppier because you are allowing people to fail, you know. And so it's I think that that's super interesting, but the way it's framed in the miniseries, and this is where I struggle along with you, Mike, is that there is this sort of like warmth that is mm-hmm. presented with like this cleanliness, this warmth. That scene when they show up at the meeting and they show the settlers on the wall, and like that happy music's playing, and everybody is so nice, you know what I mean? Like everybody's so happy together, and obviously they would be because they've gathered in a huge group and they've all been on their own and traveling across the country. But it's like, but there is this sort of I don't know, peacefulness that kind of reigns over Boulder, and you see like the barbecues going on, there's children everywhere, you know. And then when you go in Vegas, mm-hmm. we see dudes with beards and mm-hmm. motorcycle vests with holding, just walking down the street carrying fucking semi-automatic rifles, you know. And it's
that,
like
that one shot of the guy where his gut out, and then the motorcycle guy, it's like
yeah.
the first shot that in Vegas I was just cracking
same,
up
because
it's literally like they're like Mick Garris is like, all right, now stay center, this is really going to show that we're with the villains, the gross, you know, that this the dredges of society,
right, which is something that like they try to say, like in the book they actively push against that narrative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And mm-hmm. also like I know in part four, Randall Flagg like does try to say like our society is better than yours, you know, and they try to pull that talking point from the book, but it doesn't really work when the only depictions you show is like it's like cars on fire and like scary looking dudes with guns, you know, whereas like everybody in the free zone kind of, you know, they look like families, you know, look like suburban families.
And honestly, like to digress on that point just a little bit, it's that it's just so simple and boilerplate. When you get that those two opposing sides, and even just now looking out, like the settlers thing is a really interesting point, because that's all just totally, you know, rewritten history. And when you look, when you really think about it, I mean, like, what were the settlers? Well, you know, they came over with a lot of diseases. There's they raped and pillaged. They destroyed a previous civilization, and it actually kind of feeds into what Glenn's discussing at the amphitheater, which is that the way that we were is why they are now, and why things, you know, fell apart, why, you know, things fell apart. And, you know, as they say, to quote the classic Roots album, that used the age old adage. For me, what really stands out and hurts this movie more is that ignorance towards it. So it actually kind of comes off as like schmaltzy smugness. And to the point that I always, and it's so blatantly white, and I never do that. And I don't want to try to get onto to that point a little bit too much, but it is. And it's like when you have that, and you have like that one portrait where it just totally like leans in on this like fabricated history, dismissing the true nature of why this country exists. And then you also have that sort of like, well, we're holier than, it just comes off as holier than now, you know, too long. Didn't
well, it
read,
makes,
so.
It makes Glenn's stuff feel like lip service, right?
Yeah.
Because the world that they're showing isn't that complicated. And I think the thing that really encapsulates that for me is Larry and Nadine, because Larry's been this like problematic dude who treats women like shit and is really selfish and, you know, is in it for himself. And then, but when he shows up in the free zone, suddenly he's not wearing black anymore. He's wearing a blue vest and like a gray shirt. And suddenly the little boy, Joe, who was feral when he met him and tried to stab him, is suddenly like happy and good, and Larry's got his arm around him. Like, we don't see that transition. Yeah. And so Larry is just suddenly good, and Joe is suddenly good because they arrived in Boulder. Whereas Nadine shows up and she's got gray hair, red lipstick, and she approaches Mother Abigail, and Mother Abigail screams, what I have her with the line down. Who is this woman who comes, you know? And she's just immediately distrustful of her. And so it does paint that portrait of Larry is good and Nadine is evil. And it is that complex. And they physically manifest in that way. Like, Larry just looks cleaner, like, from top to bottom. Like, he shaves and everything, you know? And it's like Nadine gets all these darker features to her. I think the gray hair is super sexy, honestly. But it is meant to be, like... she's, you know, she's become darker, you know what I mean? And so it's to me sort of, that's sort of the encapsulation, I think, of what bugs me about this, is that there is this clear demarcation between what is good and what is evil. And there is, and the thing is, it's filmed like a Christian movie, you know,
exactly.
Like a lot of that stuff.
That's another huge major issue.
You know,
what's up, Mac?
They only had 6 hours to tell this whole story. No, I agree with y'all. I do. I think it feels like a chapter that we thought was too long for a specific reason. I feel like to cut the ad hoc meetings down, sure, but to spend as little time as they do with this chapter, it does do a disservice, because, like you said, everything becomes kind of like a caricature of what it is in the novel, because they only have an hour and a half to get these points across. But I feel like you had an hour and a half. That's a long time, you know, like they should have jumped time a bit more, because it would have been nice to see the slow burn of Larry coming around to who he is now. You know what I mean? We don't get to see any of that. They just jump time, and they expect us to just be along for the ride now. And we're like, okay, well, we knew maybe he was going on that direction, so I guess we have to just accept it. But it's like you're asking people to swallow, you know, and they haven't even, you know, they haven't seen it happen.
No, and most of it's all aesthetics. It's like, well, you know, you get the slimy Larry and Nadine, the rejection music from W.G. Snuffy Walden to know that something sinful is happening. And then, like, you know, Nadine's supposed to be wearing the sultry red dress that's taken right off of the shelf of Red Shoe Diaries. And then, you know, you have the sort of the black and white of Mother Abigail, the beacon of good, saying specifically what you were just saying, Randall, so that the viewer can go, oh, she's bad, without having any real reason why. I mean, the lack of nuance is so devastating, especially in this chapter, because, like, as much as we want to, like, you know, frown and go and just get and scoff at all the ad hoc meetings, what King does really well in these chapters in the book is meditate with the characters and kind of evolve their arcs and get into a place that makes sense for the final, you know, end game. So, you know, like, Larry is a perfect example of this in the sense that we really only see him on the highway playing, you know, guitar with this god-awful portrait of a CGI, like, burning, you know, horizon. And then, you know...
Hey, come on.
Yeah, you know, it's 94 or whatever. But then, you know, he meets Joe and his mother and automatically is, like, made a kind of a 180 without us even seeing any sort of revelation. And, you know, yeah, we only get a few amount of moments for any character because there's only so many episodes and there's only so much runtime, but it just seems like the more they put band-aids on things and the more they connected bridges, you know, the bridges keep getting rickety and rickety, more and more rickety, and you find yourself with a lot of islands with regards to characters where they're just like, oh yeah, that's it, and then that was why most of it is aesthetic that have to take on that weight and that you know, they have to kind of do the heavy lifting to make you understand thematically where everything is. And this chapter is just particularly egregious in that respect.
Well,
and I feel like in the book, like, you, they spend enough time in Boulder that you start to see that facade start to crumble a little bit. Like, there's the drunk guy who goes and throws rocks and all this stuff, and they don't know what to do about law enforcement. And while that's mundane, like, I think that bears out, Glenn's point, like, when he's having that big diatribe, like, you start to see that, yeah, Mother Abigail's got this vision, but, like, there's reality. And I think it backs up a lot of what Glenn is saying. And I remember them describing her as other directed, or him describing her as other directed, which I thought was interesting. It was the first time I'd ever heard that phrase, especially, like, growing up in the Bible Belt, where this just seemed like what I saw all the time. But I think you don't get that space here, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I remember, like, not ever caring about Larry's arc at all until I read this book as an adult, and I'd had a long distance between when I'd seen the miniseries, because you just don't, like, he changes overnight, and there's just no depth to his character, because he has an arc that's very similar to Harold's in a lot of ways, you know? Yeah. And I feel like he's just the successful version of that.
Right.
Yeah, I actually see a lot of similarities, and don't laugh, between Larry and Han Solo from the original Star Wars. I feel like Larry is very similar to the bad boy, you know, true rebel of Han Solo in A New Hope / Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back. And everything else after the first chapter and a half is where we see Han Solo after Carbonite, where he's not really taking the crazy risk, doesn't have the attitude anymore, seems to be more wholesome, almost like a family man, like dad-ish. And
now, Mike, I interject. Now, he's had a lot of time to think in that carbonite.
Oh, that's true. And maybe Larry has had a lot of time to think in the carbonite of the mind as he's walking from
New York. Larry's been on the road alone for a while.
Yeah, yeah. Either way, that's all to say is that I feel like they kind of betray the origins of Larry by just making him this kind of soft boy Christian, newborn Christian almost. It's
right.
It's just weird.
Would you have rather seen him go the Harold route?
I would rather have seen him more conflicted, you know? Like, when he's on the lawn with Nadine, why isn't it, like, even just give him a moment where he, like, absolutely even tries to kiss her, and then he's like, no, I can't do this. Like, but they're so worried that, and this comes down to even just kind of, like, boilerplate television of the early 90s, that, like, even if you hint that someone's going to be doing something evil, they're evil. Like, you know, we love the idea of Breaking Bad now, where you can have that nuance of, like, where he starts off good and then slowly unravels and becomes bad. But at this time in television, at this point at least, you don't really get that gray area. It's either one side or the other.
No, it's very true.
Mm-hmm. So. They have to convince him to join the committee, too. you know? And that, I thought, was like a lot of depth to his character. Like, he didn't want to take responsibility for anything anymore because he was terrified of it. And like, that kind of informs him, like, leading the charge in the fourth chapter. And we miss all of that.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
there's the mentorship with him and the judge that we lose. Like, I think at the end of this, and I might have missed something, but is this the first scene we actually see him interact with the judge when he's sending him off to be a spy?
He mentions the judge like in the meeting, but the first time you see him interact with him is that scene when he sends him off. So there's that. And then also, like, can we just talk a little bit about the scene with Nadine on the lawn? Because that scene like makes me angry because it's like she comes and makes herself vulnerable to him. Like she basically says, like, help me, save me. And he like throws her away. And why? Like, what did she even do? You know,
she
like,
says the only way to save, the only way to be saved is to fuck her. That's it. If she was just like, I need you like as a friend or whatever, or I need you to help me, it'd be one thing. But she's like, the only way that I can be saved is if you sleep with me. So it's like, I think that is a rushed scene. I think they were like, well, we need to like get from point A to point B, so we have to do this.
But and he's so self-righteous because he's like Lucy is my wife, wife, you know. And then it's
he's
like,
and that's what's frustrating though, because we've jumped so much time. Mm-hmm. You're like, wait, when did they get married? Like, how long have they been on the road? Yeah, you don't know the time frame's so weird. And let me jump back to this time frame thing. I'm really confused because did we talk about this last time where Franny is due in January.
Mm-hmm.
The outbreak doesn't really start till June. How is this Stu's baby?
It's not Stu's baby.
It's Jess's baby.
But see, that's really confusing because they don't lay it out there at all. I mean, you know that's from the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, from the get-go in the book,
They make it seem like it's not, because the way that she tells... tells Stu, she's like, there's a whole sequence there where they're like looking at each other, and it's very much the whole like, I just told you that this baby is yours, and like, are you going to react in a positive way or in a negative way? It's very, very weirdly done, because had they just said like, because then he says, have you told Harold? Which makes it sound like it is them, it is their baby.
But also, it doesn't make sense. Yeah, because she tells Stu, and then he reacts by like banging her. So you think that it was his, and then when doesn't Stu have like his arm around her like when she tells Harold? Am I wrong?
When they're walking back to camp, he does.
Yeah, there's like just this sense that, because like it arrives with her also with them also telling Harold that they're together, so that those revelations like come at the same time. And
yeah,
and it really, like, when I was a kid, I always thought it was Stu's baby, but rewatching it, they just don't clarify it's Jess's baby. But like, if you go into it thinking, like, knowing it's Jess's baby, then it works that way. But but they don't make it implicitly clear, which I do think is really weird.
Well, because this is the first time we, like, the audience learns that she's pregnant, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yes. So that, and, like, if we had seen a little bit, and that's with, like, with her diaries, we are, like, firmly where she is, and we understand why she's afraid to tell Stu and to tell anybody else, but we don't get any of that here. It's very, like, I really feel like this episode could have been split and just further developed, although I really think the whole thing could have just been a 10-episode series now, you know?
Yeah. Well, it is going to be this fall.
Yeah, it is.
Well, if it comes out this fall,
we'll see if that works.
I mean, this goes back to what we were talking about in the first episode, is that that's why I think that this show could go the route of what they tried to do with Under the Dome and make it like an actual multi-season story. Oh, because that way you get the room to really go in and dig into these characters and get into the sort of complexities that you might see in Harold, or even to some degree Nadine, although I still think King kind of shorthands her in the book also. But, you know.
I think, Mike, the problem with that, though, is, like, if history serves, that is just an awful opportunity for people to go in there and write a bunch of stuff that's not in the books.
Mm-hmm. Well, because they're trying to like, keep
to
it going.
Drag some of this stuff out. And, like, that gets scary, because then you're just, like, what is going on? You get that weird season two killer storyline from Friday Night Lights, you know? Like, yeah. you can't do
or they find the tailies from Lost.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yes.
Or Nikki. Is that who it is? Yeah, God.
Paolo and Nikki.
Ooh.
Oh, God. Anyway.
Nikki and Paolo.
Oh, Randall, I wanted to ask you a question. This is a little out there. Were you dying laughing when they go into the church and the preacher is dead on the pulpit?
Yeah. I have thoughts. So there's a couple moments like that. Jen, just so you know, in our previous episodes, I've been sort of railing against any moment where you just see dead people like in the middle, like they were in the middle of doing something and they just drop dead.
Like playing ping pong.
Yes, like playing ping pong or like, you know, moments like that. And we kind of talked through like I think Dan Caffrey was a big defender of those moments because he's, oh, you know, it works really quick on you. And so, but for me, I think it's like, so there's one where you see a guy going, when they turn the power on, you see the dead guy in the car going through the car wash. And I'm just kind of like, this man literally drove his car, and then like the 2 minutes that it takes to go through a car wash, it lost power and he died like in there. Like, come on.
Well, don't worry, Randall. In season two of The Stand, we get to find out his story.
It's so weird. And so, but then also, they go in the church, and hey, it's a great shot. Like, I love seeing the priest dead on the pulpit. I love all the people in their church clothes dead in the pews. But what that shot says to me is that, like, they all died at the exact same time.
Yes, exactly.
Like, somebody came in and mowed them down in a rain of bullets. Like, that's the only way that makes sense. You don't, like, the priest isn't up there, like, coughing and then collapsing on his pulpit and just laying there dead as the rest of the people in the pews also die slowly from a disease, you know? It's like, that's what I think is so weird about all of it. It's like, when you have those moments that are really cool in theory, they don't support, like, they don't stand up to any kind of, like, reality about how people die from this virus. So,
right.
It's not an instantaneous death.
No.
So, I don't know. Those moments always get me riled up because I just start thinking about the logistics of it. And I'm just like, it doesn't hold water. But okay, let's talk about moments that you thought were particularly awful.
Oh.
And hey, we don't want to sound like haters. We've talked a lot about this stand on this podcast, and we do overall have a lot of affection for this, but especially in this section, there's some rough stuff. So, Mac, why don't you start? What is a scene that you think is particularly egregious in part three, the betrayal?
Oh, the disco Nadine sequence.
Why do you hate it?
The cool Harold, who also, a disservice to Harold, we had not fleshed out his love for disco up to this point, so this comes out of left field, and it's very frustrating, because I didn't peg him for a disco lover, and the way that he wears his like knee-high socks in every sequence when he's like doing it with Nadine, it's so gross. Can't handle it.
Yeah.
Parker Lewis would never wear that.
Man. Right. I know. I'm like, synchronize that watch, sir, and get those socks off.
And that jacket.
That sequence is pretty awful. I have a ton.
What about when the kids
around in
like
a circle here?
Yeah.
Wait, what, Mike?
What about when the kid's like, Mommy Abigail?
Yeah. Okay. That
it's
whole
mother,
sequence.
Okay.
Lame. God.
I hate that sequence when everybody arrives and you see them all like staring up at her with like wonderment in their eyes.
It's embarrassing is what
right because the thing is, like, what Glenn is saying sort of, you know, challenges that notion, that idea that they are deifying this woman, and but the thing is, that scene, it's presented as like the proper reaction Nadine is vilified for not doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess, like, but what I think is so funny about that scene is, like, Rob Lowe is in the background just eating snacks. Like, I was cracking up because I'd
There's
never noticed
realism.
It before. But I know, but he's like sitting there like eating like ham, like, you know, like just slices of ham or something. And I was cracking up because it struck me as like he didn't realize they were filming or something.
Maybe he's like Brad Pitt where he just has to eat in every scene. You know.
But I also keep going around. I was just going to say the secrets in the beginning. I was like, everybody has a leather jacket? They're like all on the motorcycles.
You have to if you ride a motorcycle.
Apparently. I think Glenn's the only one bucking the trend.
Yeah. I wish Glenn did wear one, like Ray Walston in leather.
Like, he just, like, he won't stop wearing them, like, the rest of the series. He's just always in a leather jacket. And they're like, oh, hey, Harold. And like, oh, sorry, Glenn.
Hey, East Texas, Harold, check this out. And he's, like, standing next to Kojak.
Doing
with,
wheelies
like,
on his motorcycle.
Full leather, yeah.
He's would have fringe on it, too, I think.
Yeah. Kojak's got a little
Kojak's
leather dog
sidecar.
Yeah. Oh my God, that'd be amazing. Like Indiana Jones Last Crusade.
Jen, what is a moment that you maybe cringed at a little bit?
The whole Nadine and Harold section. It's one of the few parts in the book that I really don't like. And I was writing notes, and I don't know if this is too crass for the podcast, but I was like, why is this fucking hole so sacred? Like, I hate the whole concept, like the purity that like virginity is presented as, and how like there's this like such a clear line between being like a whore and like a Madonna. And I just hate that element. I hate how like she's using that, or like she's being used to manipulate Harold. I think it like minimizes like a character that I think could be really intriguing, because like her choice to stay, if given the amount of thought that Harold gets in the book about whether he stays or goes, like I wish Nadine had more of that, and I wish we saw her like struggle with that a little bit more and in less cheesy ways. Like, she basically comes back to the I Know What You Did Last Summer house, and that's what makes her go to Harold. And it's just so cheesy, and it's like diminishes her and just presents women in, I feel like, this really gross way of like, there's this one thing you do and that makes you a bad girl, and everything else makes you like something like you can use this sexuality to get what you want. And it's gross. And I love Laura San Giacomo, and I think she's doing what she needs to do with this part, but it's just gross. And it's gross in the book too.
Yeah, I love that line Harold says, though, you look so tasty, so juicy.
It's so like, gross.
Oh God.
Yeah. Just... he's only been watching porn.
It is something else. Yeah, I agree with you. I it's one of those sequences where you want Nadine, like when they're gonna blow up the house, she's got to know Larry's in the committee meeting. Mm-hmm. and it's like she's just totally turned her back. It's I don't know, maybe I'm reading that wrong. And I know that he's being really snippy with her, and she's kind of like being, you know,
when people are snippy with me, I want to blow them up with a bomb.
But it's like,
well, she's a scorned woman, you know, and I feel like that's like a reductive thing.
And let me ask this question. Nadine, she goes to the house in the middle of the fucking day. No one happens to be there. She's lucky as hell. She's got a shoebox under her arm. What if someone was home? They're not looking. They're like, what the fuck? What's in the shoebox? Like, they're not checking this shoebox.
I assume she did her anything diligence. Else.
Okay, Randall. Yeah, that's why she goes up to the door and knocks.
Can we talk about Harold's dream?
Oh, God.
Oh, yeah.
You mean the one that Joel Schumacher cut as a kid. Out of Batman Forever?
It really is.
All the neon.
It does, it does feel like they just had some shit laying around, you know? Like, they had the like, I don't know what kind of, I said weird wolf beast that's in the car that says the wild card. He's, you're a real card, huh? And it's like, and then, but that just, like, what place does that creature have in the world of the stand? Like, it's
well,
like
you know
a dead
what?
Person
you know
in a car.
Is.
Who?
It's the kid. It's the kid.
Yeah, yeah, but like,
it's
why
their
is
nod
he,
to the kid.
But why is he a wolf?
He's a he's not a wolf. He's just a grizzled corpse. He's burned. He's
no,
burned
he
up.
Is like a creature.
Well, the wolves
no,
ate
just,
him in the
no,
book,
it's
right?
Like,
so maybe
oh
he
yeah, I guess you're right. The wolves
wolf.
Did eat him.
Oh, maybe that's a good take. Yeah,
maybe they were werewolves.
Yeah,
they
he
could
has
be.
Like he has
he
like
was a werewolf.
Vibes.
Randall, wake up.
Okay. Hey, you know what? You sold me. I'm in on that scene now. But
all right, yes.
What part of the cycle are we in though? Is the question? Mm.
Yes. But no, it's like the lighting is so weird. It is very Batman Forever. And it's like, and it's just such a weird scene. And I always crack up because there's a moment like this in another place that I brought up as well in the miniseries. But, oh, it's like when, like, clearly things were filmed like at different times. So there's like a scene when Stu is walking through the hospital in his dream and he sees this guy with like blood pouring out of his mouth, and it's a really horrific shot. But then when it cuts to Stu, it's like he just kind of glances at it and keeps moving, like barely reacts to it. And it's clearly because, you know, they probably added it after the fact. And yeah. And then the thing like doesn't chase him or anything. It just exists, you know? And that kind of stuff always makes me laugh. But that's the thing with the, we'll call it the kid in the car that talks to Harold, is it like it wakes up and says, "You're a real car," and he goes, "Yeah, wild card," and then it just lowers its head again.
You know, it could also be the cabbie from Scrooged.
Or yeah, it's definitely the cabbie from Scrooge.
Or it could be the cabbie from Ghostbusters. How about that?
What floor?
Who are you gonna call?
I have a question for you guys. Does anyone understand why Randall Flagg's dreams for the people that he's trying to get on his side are scary? Like, Nadine dreams of Randall, so Nadine dreams of Flag. Nadine dreams of Flag, and like most of the time she wakes up like screaming because like he has to like scare her at the end, and you're like, why are you going to this guy? Like, what is the draw? Like, I know you, it's one thing to be scared of him, but like for some reason you're just like in love with him half the dream, and then you end up screaming and waking yourself up, and then you're still gonna go through with these things. It's really confusing.
Okay.
I'm like, why do you have to scare them?
I will say Jerry Dandridge in Fright Night, because, and I think like it's the reason that we're also into horror right now, you know, especially I think there's that like allure of something that's powerful and scary, you know, and when you feel like really weak and like scared, like you want to go towards something that's going to give you, that's going to seem like you're aligning yourself with more power, you know?
Yeah.
Also, like
yeah. Rather than an old woman.
I love Dandridge. Yeah.
Right. Oh God. I mean, yeah, I could talk for days about how dreamy he is in that movie, but yeah, it's like that allure of the vampire thing, you know, he's glamoring them.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. I mean, I get that, but it just seems like there's always like a scare for the viewer at the end.
Yeah.
And it's like, doesn't quite line up. I'm like, if he was just like, you know, sexy Dandridge the whole time, and then she wakes up like, holy shit, like, I've got to get to Vegas. That then I would buy it. But like half the time he's turning around to her and he's got like demon eyes, or like, you know, it's just like, why are you scaring her? Like, she's already in. She's going to kill these people.
Well, and I think that's one of the things that works better in the book, you know, and like in Harold's dreams, true. Like it talks to him about like, or talks about him like looking like a pimp, you know, and like beckoning to him and the weird Harold talk, but and like dressed more like a monk rather than scary. And I could see why Harold would be drawn to that. But yeah, I think that kind of is just a disservice to Nadine's character in general, you know,
in
the book and the movie.
I wish they were able to do it more like a John Waters movie or some sort of like meta commentary. And it's just like Flag in front of like a really cheap Las Vegas commercial, like, hey, come to Vegas. we have great hotel rooms, all you could want, thousands of vacancies or millions of vacancies, and you like see like a bunch of b-roll of just like a bunch of his cronies just like wandering into like houses and stuff. It's just, or not even houses, but like hotel rooms, and then, you know, there's b-roll of him just like walking through like casino buffets, and it's like, he's like, hey, what's for breakfast this morning, Gene? And it's just like,
he's got to get a wind machine in his hair, you know?
Yeah. It's like, just come on down now to Flags Vegas, you'll have a good time.
Meet like, Trash Can, yeah,
someone,
man.
Someone has a dream early on and they're talking about it. Maybe it's Franny. But they say that they saw Dana, Glenn, and Judge Ferris on telephone poles. And I don't know if I caught that before, that it was like the Dark Man was showing them, like, he knows that those three are going to die. He can see into the future, but not all the way to the end, you know? And I thought that was kind of creepy.
I always
thought that imagery. Yeah, in the miniseries, someone says that they had a dream where they saw, I think it's Franny, but she says she had a dream where she saw Dana, Glenn, and Judge Ferris hanging on and then Stu finishes the dream saying, yeah, hanging on telephone poles on the highway, blah, 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 blah.
Huh.
And I was like,
is that
oh, they're
part
like,
three?
Yeah, it's in the beginning. It's right before she says, I'm pregnant. It's covered up with some huge news right afterwards.
Clearly,
she does
has
say
a
that, and I thought
set.
I was like, "Oh, I don't think I paid." I think you just kind of like when you're initially watching it. At least I know I was when I was a kid. I probably just paid no attention to that because you just think, "Well, he's just showing you whatever you want." You know, he's just trying to scare you. But
you don't know
the
who
fact
Dana
that
is
those three, people, yeah, and you don't know who Dana is really. Yeah, I just like that was the part that I did like, because I just thought, oh, it's kind of creepy.
Yeah, that's a spooky visual.
Okay.
I have a scene that this is, Jen, this is a huge running joke with a lot of the rest of the losers. I have,
I know what you're going to say.
Well, when I watched it, when Mac watched it, and when Dan Caffrey watched it, we all just taped our TVs and sent this scene to each other. And I'm going to play it for,
Can you play it? Hold on.
Yes. Let me make sure. Yeah, I got the video out. Let me make sure my headphones are unconnected from the Bluetooth. And we get this going here, so all right.
This ain't on me.
Can you guys hear it?
Guess we're all gonna have to get used to this again, huh?
We will, Stu.
That's Mac yelling.
And that's not even this. That's not even the scene.
I have part. The one, and then okay, here it is.
Well, hey, we're with you, Randall. You can do it.
So I hope you all bear with me.
So Mac filmed the other one and yelled "We will, Stu" at the wrong time, which is also funny. But then Justin also has a video, and I'll play it.
We will, Stu.
The best part is it's like beef roll footage, like they did film of the guy in the back yelling it, but they didn't decide not to use it because he's smiling afterwards too, like he's really proud of himself.
They dump Gatorade on him in an outtake, actually.
We're weirdly obsessed with the We Will Stew guy, which I think is Mick Garris.
It is Mick Garris, yeah.
Yeah. Aww. And we like to say it all the time, and Dan Dan will Dan even edited the footage together, so he does the We Will Stew and then cut, Dan yelled it and then it cut to the actual footage from the stand of everybody clapping. And it's
it's
weird.
It's followed up with that classic Larry line.
Oh, I'm on this.
I'm on this.
Which Justin also recorded himself saying, but I don't have that video handy. But we are such nerds about it. And for, I don't know, Mike, can you explain why we find that funny?
I can't.
Mac, can you explain why we find it funny?
Well, it's those scenes where just you always hear someone randomly yell something out. It's most of the time it sounds like it was added way after the fact. Like there's that scene in Rogue One when that guy in the meeting at the end is like, let her speak. But you don't know who it is. Was this added in after the fact? It's so out of place.
No, I love that kind of stuff. Classic. And Mick Garris also has a line later that cracked me up, that made me laugh in the same way, where when Mother Abigail comes back into town, he has a line where he yells, she's come back. And it just feels like so community theater, you know, it just feels like so hokey. And it just cracks me up. So it's to me a very strange sort of phenomenon that we, the losers, have picked up on as a running bit, but now it is so deeply embedded in our bits that We Will Stew cannot be met without laughs.
I have to say, I thought when you were talking about a running joke, I thought you were going to start talking about the Rat Man.
Oh, we'll get to the Rat Man.
We saved the best for last.
Before we do, let's do Rat Man, but before that, because this is related, during the meeting, there's a thing, there's another bit that caught my attention that made me laugh a lot, and I think is quite revealing. So you have Brad Kitchener and Susan Stern are the ones who restart the power plant. Mm-hmm. They never really give Sue Stern the credit. They always talk about Brad, and if they talk about Susan, they, even though she's on the committee and he's not, they always refer to her as being with Brad. So when they announce the thing, they only give Brad credit for the power plant, even though you saw Sue there. And then when they announce that Sue is on the committee, they describe her as Brad's good friend, Susan Stern. Mm-hmm. And then later, when the bomb is about to blow up, some of them sense it. Like Nick senses it, and then Ralph senses it. Mm-hmm. And then Susan goes, "Ralph, what's happening?" And I'm like, why doesn't Sue sense it if she's special too. And it just made me think Sue Stern does not get her just due in this story.
I feel like that was their way, because because everyone that senses it, save for, you know, Nick, gets out.
And I that's feel not like that true because Nick is the first one who senses it.
No, I'm saying everyone but Nick. Nick does sense it, but he's the only one that. But Nick, you know, he's a hero. He's got to go for the
but,
bomb.
But is he a hero? I mean, he doesn't really do anything. Like, when you think about it, like, if you think that there's something in the house, get out of the house then. Like, Nick, what do you stay there for? Oh, so you could open the lid and then go, like, he doesn't, there's no real, like, heroism here other than the fact that, like, he doesn't actually get the bomb disarmed in time, so he dies. Like,
well, it's confusing because, well, it's not confusing, but I think everybody feels like they need to get out. But I think he's the only one really listening to Mother Abigail who's telling them it's in the closet. She doesn't say get out of the house, does she?
I mean, if you think that something's wrong, like, leave and then watch the house explode.
Well, that's true. But in the moment, I think Nick thought maybe there was something he could do. Unfortunately, it's not a grenade. It was C4 in there.
What's the point? It seems like such a loss for no reason other than the fact that you need a death. And it's always bothered me, but I also, maybe I'm just partial because I wanted to see Rob Lowe for the rest of it, other than the dubious cameo he has in the fourth.
But then you get Dream Lowe later.
So let's talk about another cameo. We don't get a lot of Vegas in this episode. We do, however, get Trash Can Man's arrival in Vegas, which he wakes up in sort of a weird bed, looks out his window and sees like a child's drawing of, you know, of
it's Agrabah from Aladdin.
Well, no, it's not a child's drawing. It's everyone's screensaver from Windows 95.
I've just walked into the mist.
Yeah.
But then Lloyd comes in with Ratman, and this is a scene totally made up, because Ratman doesn't show up till like the very end of the book. And but they had Rick Avilas. They said, we got to use this guy. He's great. And he is great. And, but he comes in and they just give him these absurd lines when and I love that he just, I don't know, the idea of introducing yourself as the Ratman is very funny to me.
Yeah.
So he's just like, I'm the Ratman, and this here is Lloyd Henry. He ain't bad for a slice of Wonder Bread or something like that.
It's such a Stephen King thing, too.
It is.
Yeah.
But it's like so weird. And then he's like so excited. He's like, ooh, good to meet you, Trish.
You know what's funny in that sequence, too, is that, you know, Lloyd's like looking good. You know, he's like, you know, he's like suited up or whatever. Ratman has the same shit on that he had early on. You know? Maybe he's got slightly better looking hat. You know what I mean? Like, he doesn't care. He's just there. He's there for the party, you know?
But doesn't it seem like everyone wears the same thing in this movie? Like, they're cartoon characters. Like, I was texting with Randall last night and about Tom's red shirt. And I got made
well,
fun
now,
of.
Well, now, Mike, Tom, you know, he's making his own decisions now.
I know that, but here's, all right, so, but then you look at Stu, and it's like, all right, Stu, in this movie, you're going to wear a white shirt and jeans, and that's it. Occasionally, you get it, maybe a leather jacket and potentially a flannel here and there. Harold, you're going to be relegated to strictly leather.
With pearls
I think you need to
it.
Talk to the costume designer for the stand.
Ooh, I might. I mean,
some valid issues here.
The only person who has any costume changes is the person who's told to stand up and to everyone to applaud at how beautiful she is.
Look at him. Show him your nice little dress.
Franny, I want you to stand up and show him how pretty you look in that dress.
Did not like that part. Yeah, the clothing in the costuming is hideous in this whole thing.
Yeah.
Well, how about the dress she wears in
the 90s? Yeah.
Yeah, but in the hair too. Yeah, I mean, I'm probably judging it harshly, but it also looks like cheap costuming too, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's CBS, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, she's dressed like a wood nymph when in her dream with Mother Abigail after the bomb explodes.
I know.
Yeah, and it's a Christmas pattern. Like, what is she going to a Christmas-themed garden party?
And this is also, like, where, again, the Franny Goldsmith in the book is just, like, murdered in this series. Like, I don't think Molly Ringwald does a bad job, technically, with, like, her portrayal of this version of Franny, sure. But it's just always like after you read the book, you're like, ah, this is like such a wrong casting decision for Franny. Like, Franny is not you know, we needed like Jennifer Jason Leigh in here.
Oh man, that was amazing. What if we had like Noah Baumbach had directed the Stand miniseries, and you had like Jennifer Jason Leigh as Franny. You get Ben Stiller as Stu. Yeah, Ben Stiller as Stu. I don't know what you're talking about.
Ben Stiller.
The world
would
on
be,
my fucking shoulders.
Oh God.
So let's talk. And then I guess just the other thing too is like we. And this is related to the idea that we don't really get a sense of what people do. You know what I mean? Like we don't see. And so, but like Lloyd, like you see him and he's dressed up and he's there with Flag in Vegas, but it's like, what does he do?
I know.
You know what I mean? He's just there and he's aligned with Flag, but you don't really like see what he actually does.
Yeah, that is weird. You see a lot of like other people bossing people around, you know, like on the airfield and stuff like that. You know, like, you're like, why couldn't they get Miguel Ferrer in those scenes? Like,
I know
he literally is like apparently he's just in charge of trash. He doesn't do a very good job either. You know, like it's so weird.
Well, that was a big gripe with the actual book is the lack of chapters dedicated to Vegas. It's like you go. Dedicated with all the people that are going to, you know, to the Vegas area. And then all of a sudden, 400 pages later, not even, I think it's even more than that. It's maybe 500, 600 pages later. Then you're all of a sudden, you're like back in Vegas. And you're like, whoa, a lot of things have changed.
Yeah, I remember we talked about that in the episode, like how many pages there were with no Vegas.
Do you all think that this new miniseries, because we have such like in-your-face programming these days, like you were saying, Mike, with Breaking Bad, like, people aren't afraid to watch things that are difficult and with like harried characters that are, you know, just more gray, like you were saying.
Yeah.
Do you think we will get more of the realistic version of Vegas where there's like families and shit there and, you know, people are like, you know, it's almost like the version of Vegas in the book to me felt like it felt like Boulder just. There was just like that fear that if you stepped out of line, you'd get killed.
Yeah.
And you have a bit of the lottery feel, you know, it's like all of a sudden everyone's showing up to watch this execution.
Yeah.
But like before that, like it is a well-oiled machine. And they do show that when they first show Vegas that they're already cleaning up and doing all the things that like the committee hasn't even decided to do yet. They haven't even.
But they're also just haphazardly
that, you know
walking
I mean?
Around with assault guns.
Yes, yes. But I'm just saying is like that's very true. But I feel like the audience today is ready for the Vegas that we want.
Well,
portrayed.
I agree.
I'm very interested to see if you're going to see that.
But it's like King talks a lot in the book about how many kids are in Vegas. Like that's something
like
he discusses
or something.
A lot. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
And that to me, and I think that's probably with this being on network TV. They were like, well, if we blow them all up at the end, we can't show any kids. You know what I mean? And I think that's probably was a consideration. And obviously now I think that wouldn't be as much of an issue because we're all broken dark inside anyways. So it's like, but I do find that really interesting. And because King really does highlight how many children there are in Vegas. Like I remember that specifically. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, let's talk about one very important part of part three, which is Stephen King's cameo as Teddy Weizak. What is everybody's thoughts on this? Mike, let's start with you.
Well, I love his relationship with Nadine. just love it. I mean, just flat out embarrassed by her. Almost mean-spirited. It's almost just like a frustrated stepfather. That's the physical demeanor he presents. It's like, you're going to embarrass me in front of Mother Abigail, you little...
There's this, like, sense of responsibility that he has for her, you know, that I don't feel like is really earned in the thing. But, yeah, like, that meta quality of his cameo, that's something that actually kind of moved me a little bit. Because, like, Randall, I think you were talking about how, like, kind of bullshit it is, how they all come up to Mother Abigail and they're just looking in awe at her.
Yeah.
And the one person I will allow that from... with Stephen King, because I was thinking, like, here's this character that he created, and I just try to put myself in his shoes, and like, what would it be like to actually see this person? You know, like, it would almost be like watching like Roland come to life, you know. And so I could kind of let him like kind of enjoy that a little bit. And then I also like, if you talk about the cordwood stuff, like when he's kind of confronted with these gross scenarios that he's created, like I liked how they kind of, I think they were kind of intentional in how they used his cameo, as cheesy as
totally.
It kind of was.
Even the fact that he says cordwood, because it's like, yeah, that's my description. I came up with it. it.
Exactly.
Because I remember there's like a lengthy discussion on our original podcast about this where we were like, what the fuck is cordwood? And then, you know, you look it up and you're like, why are they so disgusted by the idea of cordwood? Is it just because it's like the layering of bodies that they associate with how he says cordwood? It's just such a weird sort of implied word association there. You're like, oh, yeah, no, we understand why they're grossed out by that. But
I don't think they're grossed out by the cordwood. It's the fact that the bodies have become the consistency of cordwood.
I could get that.
I think more of that. I think that's interesting. I haven't really looked. You know, Randall's a hater of Teddy, and I was ready for everyone to just throw him on the fire. I do like Jen's. I do like what Jim was saying. But like, there was that scene where when he does see Mother Abigail, and he's just like Mother Abigail, and he almost
Mother
like
Abigail.
If they had stayed Mother with Abigail. Him, if the camera didn't go off to someone else, and they had just followed him all the way up, running up to Mother Abigail. I don't know what that looks like. The way that he approaches her is very like off-putting. He's clearly part of the problem that's like deifying her and whatnot. But it didn't bug me that much. I think when I was a kid, I'm trying to think if I knew that that was him.
I don't think I did.
Because I don't know if I really knew what he looked like, you know, because The Stand was one of the first things that I watched that really got me into King, but I'm sure Justin probably told me or something, you know, when we were watching it.
I want to hear Randall's thoughts.
Yeah,
I always knew it was him because his face was all over, you know, the back of books. And even though this was the first thing I ever read, I had looked at his books in stores before and I'd seen him on TV before and various things. So I remember knowing it was him. And I liked his cameo when I was young. But now that I'm older, I hate it. And I think it's because, like, I love his cameo in Pet Sematary, right? Like, where he's the priest and he's got, like, one line maybe. And that's the kind of cameo I like from him because I don't want, even though Stephen King in many ways has already shattered the mystique of being Stephen King because he's a very public figure and he talks a lot. It's like there is something about him sort of, I don't know. And the word, this is the thing, is I'm going to be harsher. I'm going to sound harsher than I really am. But it's like there's this sense of almost like debasing himself.
Yeah.
Like in this. And I think it's just because he's. For me personally, he's immersing himself too deep in this world. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to see the author immerse that deep in there, especially when it's in parts of the story that I'm not a huge fan of, which is like the way that the Boulder Free Zone is depicted in here, which isn't necessarily how I feel like he depicted it in the book. Mm-hmm. Like the scene when they're at the meeting and him and Mick Garris are sitting together and they're like clapping about everything, you know, and like cheering Stu on and everything. Like you see those scenes a lot. And then you also see him like, I don't know, I just think about like, here's the guy who created this big, amazing world and this incredible story and all these characters. And he's like just getting shuffled around from scene to scene to play like an extra. You know, there's just something about it that like makes me like, it pulls me out of the story. He's not a particularly good actor. We know that about him. And it just seems kind of hokey and cheesy. And the tone of the piece to me, like, I don't mind Jordy Verrill because that's comedy. Yeah. You know, like, that's supposed to be silly. But here it's, like, supposed to be serious scenes and you've got Stephen King in the middle of them, like, mugging it up, you know? And, like, clearly, like, relishing the idea that everybody's going to recognize him, you know, because he's playing this role. If he was in one scene, in one small role, then I would like it, you know? But it's like,
what role would that have been, Randall?
I don't know, the dead guy in the car wash.
I think a dead body would have been interesting if he was that, or like even someone that was working in the power plant or something like that. Like he hits a lever and you're like, oh, there's Stephen King.
Like in Mr. Mercedes,
think,
he popped up
I think
as a dead
the,
body.
The monster crier would have been cool.
Yeah, see, I would have been fine with that. It's like because in Mr. Mercedes, he showed up as like a dead body, like with a knife in him, and that was fun. You know, it's like because that's a relatively serious story, and they didn't linger on it too long. Like I know you like it, Mike, and stuff, but like I do not like his cameo in it, Chapter 2, because I'm like, this is too self-aware. It's too self-indulgent. If he had like one line, it might be funny, but like I'm not here for the meta moment with Stephen King. thing. You know, mm-hmm. it's like, I like him in Pet Sematary where he's an ominous presence in that world because that's such a dark story. You know,
well, I traditionally like those moments for cameos regardless. It's just like, I like the less is more when it comes to something
big. And so I find him very ominous and scary in Pet Sematary. You know, it's like, it's a moment that I get a chill because he is there as like a holy figure there for a very brief moment. And that to me is like super spooky.
Go for it.
Oh, I was just going to say, like, that's my thing is this isn't a hill I would die on or anything. Like, obviously it's not like it's a very his cameo is very sweet. Like, I'm just being a hater. But it's like but I just like I find myself being like, Stevie, you're debasing yourself by doing this. Like, you are playing too large of a role in an imperfect version of this world that you created. And like, it's, I don't know, it's weird to me. And I almost would have preferred to see him in Vegas and, hey, his leather vest might have fit in a little bit more over there. So
I think and you also would have fit in more with, like, the cameos he's surrounded by, you know? Like, when you get, like, Tom Holland or you get, like, Sam Raimi and even John Landis, like, why not be surrounded with them? Like, if you're going to fulfill the joke, like, yeah, you have all these horror directors. You're also a master of horror, and you directed Maximum Overdrive by this point. So you are kind of like a director in the sense also. So why not do that? It's almost like,
yeah,
because he's a screenwriter, he felt maybe like, well, I could take this part also. But I agree with you, Randall. I think that seeing him in these moments that are just so garish and also seemingly contradict everything that you put to paper, it's almost like he's giving it a stamp of approval. He's celebrating this like world that he's creating. And then when you get back to the idea that all this stuff is so like so schmaltzy and so smug, he's then roped into it, you know? And like, I don't know, like, I know it sounds so outlandish to say that, but like, I just watch these scenes and they're so smug. It's like, I almost like, I don't like sympathize with Harold, but I could see why he hates these people. Like, I would totally be like there sitting there being like, all right, I'm going to throw these fucking bodies away. I'm going to go home and I'm going to drink and like watch the fucking television fuzz for a while and just think about how dumb this world is.
Throw a bunch of rocks through windows.
It's so black and white.
I would. Yeah.
I think the perfect sequence that could have been like when they all go to clean the church, if everybody had their faces covered, and then at the end of that sequence when they're at like the junkyard like dumping the bodies, like they all pull their masks down for like a heartbeat and it's all those horror directors cleaning up the mess, you know what I mean?
And
like that would have been like funny,
and one of them's like,
and literally just cuts the next scene. Like, it's just like, if you know who they are, it's funny, but it doesn't take away from the
I think you could earn a funny moment. You could have them all take off the mask and then one of them's like, so is the Sizzler still open? And then like, cuts
the Sizzler.
That old Sizzler.
What if he's the priest that's dying on the altar, you know?
Yeah.
And that's like kind of revisiting the Pet Sematary cameo.
Yeah.
Or what if he is the werewolf that tells Harold he's a wild
guy?
I'm into that.
King, the original kid.
You know,
could reuse some of his Jordy Verrill costumes too.
Yes.
There is a cameo in here that I love.
What's that?
And it's going to take us to a small town up in the Pacific Northwest called Twin Peaks. we get Warren Frost, who's Doc Hayward in Twin Peaks, also of Seinfeld fame, who's playing Dr. George Richardson. And God, does this guy have a face for a doctor or what? Like, I mean, just fucking great. I love him in every scene in this. This could have been a cameo that King does, but I'm just glad we got Warren Frost in it. The late Warren Frost.
This doc could check me out, you know?
Yeah. God. It's like, I got something on my penis. Here, look at
one last line that like, I have a love-hate relationship with, because here's the thing. I love Ossie Davis as the judge. I wish that they gave him more, because he's an incredible actor, incredible legacy, great playwright as well. Guy's had an amazing career. And
one of two black people in Boulder.
Exactly, yeah. Okay. And so I wish we could have seen a little bit more, but I hate the line. I like the way he delivers it in a way, but it's also like it falls in line with all the sort of like spiritual folksiness of sort of the Free Zone in that scene, is when they like basically say like, well, can we just accept the committee as is, you know? And then and he just they're like, judge, he's like, you damn right you can, and I for one think it's a damn good idea.
I know, it's so overwrought and also just like really tacky and kind of cliche.
Like, why are they
using the word damn twice in one sentence too?
And like, why are they all so excited to have like these people at the top. Like, why is it such a damn good idea? Just because they trust Mother Abigail that much, or do they all think the that it's Larry like, should be the guy running the town?
Yeah, it's very the whole like blind faith thing rings true in that whole sequence. Yeah. And it's almost to me it feels deliberate. You know what I mean? Like,
sure.
Like you can tell, like even when they accept it, you can see there's a shot of Larry where he's like still like, oh shit, like I gotta do this now. But and like that's all he gets though. You know what I mean? We don't get to see him like really grappling with like being on the thing, like in the book, you know. But like, you know, it's all you could really do. But yes, I agree. I love Ossie Davis. I think that sequence in the next, we'll get to it with him is kills me. But I wish we had a lot more of him for sure. I want to ask everybody a couple quarantine questions.
Let's hear it.
If we're moving on. They mention the flu and they say, who says it's gone? If our babies will be immune. And I wanted to ask with this whole COVID-19 thing, because, you know, there's like articles that have come out saying, you know, well, people that have had it are getting it again.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do we feel about the, like when this stay at home thing cools off and people start going back out there, this also lends to the next question, which is the quarantine. Like, should we just go back to the way we were doing things?
Well, I don't think people will be able to. I think there's too much paranoia because it's like, yeah, you can get sick again. And it's like, Asia has already experienced a second wave, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's the thing is that's what's so horrifying about all this is like, we're not going to be comfortable like we used to be going to crowded places until there is a vaccine, you know?
Right,
and even then it's like the disease is still in the air. It's like, you know, I think what is so hard about all this is like, you know, I know you guys probably are too, but it's like, I'm somebody who loves going to live music and I'm seeing people say it'll be fall 2021 before we get to go to live music again, you know? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And like that. And then of course, like you think about the freaking industry and it's like, Jesus Christ, like what's going to happen? Like, are we going to be doing quarantine bedroom shows for another year and a half? You know?
Could be.
Everything's going to pivot hard.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of it goes down to, you know, the being logical about it, which is, you know, we live in a current world where we can't be, you know, those at top, don't even know how to define that word. And, am I for, a return to work, you know, to break these stay at home orders? I mean, if there's some science behind it and there's some sort of logic, like I think the idea of kind of rolling things out one by one could be a good thing. I think we eventually are going to get down to a situation where we are kind of teetering on an apocalyptic situation where we go, well, are we going to have deaths or are we going to have actually even more deaths because of the long-term economical effect? And I think that's something that is a hard choice that would break the strongest president to figure out. And we have arguably the weakest president that has to fucking answer that question. And that's what keeps me up at night. That's far more frustrating and scary than anything, because it's like, well, how long can you go with this? I think there's a point that Tom Savini made in an interview last week, and sorry if I sound like a star fucker throughout this whole episode, but I've just been interviewing nothing but
when I was eating with Mario Bava Tom Savini,
you're the real Robert Englund of this podcast.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah. Well, you know what? When I was sitting there with my lunch, and I had a wonderful cheese platter. And
Lucci Fulci over and give me a napkin.
I'll see you at tennis, baby. He had a really great metaphor. And you'll hear the interview next week, A Consequence of Sound. But he talked about how we're currently in a situation that's almost like a torture porn movie. It's like, well, if you know that the person that's torturing you is just going to hit you once, that's not torture. But if you don't know when this person's going to let up and how long you're going to live and bleed out, that is what makes it torture. And that's kind of what we're in right now. We don't know how long this is going to be. And that's kind of what this chapter is a little bit about. It's like that there's nothing, you can only really frame the unknown when you have something that does feel known. And that's what they have right now. Like, it's almost like they're more comfortable being out on the road, in these chapters of Stan, because it's it. There's nothing to do. There's nothing to do but to gain. And now that they have what they have again, like they have a piece of society, you have everything to lose. The dominoes can fall again. And there's an anxiety that comes with that. I don't know if this chapter succeeds in being able to show that and capture it, but the book certainly does.
Yeah. Well, we just got our Tennessee orders that we are going to start opening up on May 1st. We got those today. Although I do think the mayor is going to have some autonomy. So, like, it kind of panicked me a little bit. I was like, well, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know if we're ready. I don't think my job is going to expect us back in the office. But, like, there's this feeling of, like, I feel like I'm kind of in a cocoon right now. Mm-hmm. And I've been thinking about this a lot more, like, on a personal level. Like, this has kind of been an opportunity for me to kind of, like, evaluate like who I am, and like when everything is stripped away and I'm just sitting here in my house all day long, like what is it that I was doing that I don't need anymore, and do I need to continue that? Like when I look at my desk, most of the stuff that I kept on my desk at work is not here, and I realized I don't need it. You know, I've totally changed how I plan. Like I'm not wearing makeup anymore, which is something I would do for work every day, and now I'm thinking like, why do I care so much about these things, and what am I going to choose to carry with me when I come back out? And I think when I got that, when I read that headline that we're going to start going back, I was like, I don't think I'm ready. You know, I don't think I've kind of thought through all of this yet. And I feel like when you're on the road, kind of like what you were saying, you're still heading towards something, and like there are so many possibilities. And then when they get to Boulder, they have to start actually making the choices, and they have to like start following through with all of these things. And I think I'm still kind of in this like ideal, like, oh, well, maybe I could just not wear makeup to work anymore, or maybe like I don't need my planner anymore. But then when you actually start to try to function again, I think it's kind of like what Glenn is always saying, like the stuff's all sitting around there, and it's so easy to fall back into those old habits of just picking the guns up, you know, or picking up the weapons. Like, are we going to fall back into these same patterns, you know?
I mean, there's been a lot of discussion. I mean, David Lynch had a really great piece that was out today on the Hollywood Reporter talking about how, you know, after this, he thinks, I mean, he's always taken the more holistic meditative approach, clearly, because he's, you know, the icon of transcendental meditation. But he talks about how, like, this is a great area, the great time for us to kind of, you know, figure out where we can kind of go and how we can be without our devices. And he has a more optimistic way of thinking, like, after this, he thinks that we're going to be a little bit more mindful. I don't think so, but, you know, yeah. I'm just cynical.
It's a nice idea.
I think there are a lot of people that will.
Yeah.
But I don't think, like, government will.
No. God,
you
no.
You know what I mean?
Not the one we have now.
Yeah. Oh, no. Yeah, absolutely
All they're
not.
Trying to do is pass the buck.
Yeah. I just, I'd like to be a little optimistic, too. And I'd like to think that, you know, at the end of this pod episode, we'll all walk off, the four of us, and one of you will fall by the way by the great W.G. Snuffy Walden will play
spoilers
in the background, because I love that piece of music.
I do too.
I think that's
give him
all the flack for some of the cues and stuff and the Nadine and Harold sequence stuff. But I love that piece of music. I love the ending of this.
The more meditative and melancholy tracks that Snuffy does here are really good.
Well, we get the worst,
like, Tom's
two
theme.
Larry and Nadine, the rejection, and then Trash Man in Vegas is just
The Vegas music, like it's just so like
bad.
What
bad.
Vegas is this guy? If this is W.G. Walden's hell, like,
you guys'
lame
rendition was fantastic, by the way.
I had a great life to think that is like what's going to be playing in hell.
Well, then in that case, I'm definitely choosing Boulder.
So what are your final thoughts about The Stand Part 3, The Betrayal? Mike, let's start with you.
Oh, boy. Easily the weakest chapter of the four. I think it's not too hard to see why, based on just the hour and a half that we've discussed on this, but aesthetically it's lame. This is when you start dipping into what I've been saying all along, it's the more Hallmarkian uber Christian qualities that make this just so garish and almost offensive. No, it is offensive. I just think it's just like I feel like an outcast. I actually feel like Nadine and Harold here, because it just seems so like, well, we're going to be good, and good is Christian, and that's it. There's no discussion. And I've been saying smug a lot, and this feels like a very smug chapter. So the weaker the sins of this miniseries manifest themselves in this chapter for me. Having said that, I do love my boy Ray Walston, the late Ray Walston, delivering some great speeches in the amphitheater. And that's about it. I don't think that there's much for me. So we're not doing any nosers for this one yet.
No,
right?
we'll do noses. No. Whoever's on the next one, we'll do all noses. Right. So. Yeah. Jen, how about you?
So when I think about this section specifically, it's kind of, to me, like a microcosm of why Stephen King adaptations so often don't work, but why people who have read the book are willing to kind of go with it, you know, because I was watching like the Tom hypnotizing scene. Mm. I was watching this, and that's such a moving part of the book, and it's because Stephen King has built these characters so thoughtfully and like laid all of this foundation. And so as I'm watching this, and I've read the book, I don't know how many times at this point, like I am like pulling from all of that. And I'm like getting like emotional while I'm watching this. But like, if you're watching this for the first time and you can't really remember who some of these characters are and like what's going on right now, you know, it just doesn't work. And I feel like it's like, they just had not figured out how to capture like all of the like complexity of these characters, you know? And I feel like with a little more room, maybe they could have done it, but this is just, it's such a big, thoughtful story. And it just, it's not adapted well here, you know?
Yeah. Mac, how about you?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it's a rush job of sorts. But I definitely agree with you in terms of, you know, when I watched this as a kid, I was watching it through a kid's lens. So mm-hmm. I've always been a very empathetic person. So I definitely, like, you know, that scene with Tom when they're putting him under, like, that really got to me back then. It gets to me now in a different way because I have read the books. You know, it's like when people throw you under the bus for liking the Harry Potter movies or something. If you read the books, you're bringing all this like hundreds of pages to these things that no one knows. So like you're sitting there having a reaction because you know the backstories of all these characters, but mm-hmm. like it looks kind of embarrassing, but you're like, no, like you don't understand. Like having read the book, some of these scenes that could come off as hokey and let's face it, they are in this version. I mean, sorry, Mick Garris, but some of them are really hokey and really ridiculous. But the only saving grace is that, like, I've read the book, and mm-hmm. so there's a weight with a lot of these characters and actors and scenes that there's a gravity there. Like when they rattle off the people that have died in the house, you know, it's, like you guys were joking around about Susan Stern not getting a lot of like play, but like, when they throw that name out there, I'm like, oh Jesus, you know,
yeah.
like,
yeah. She's
I mean,
from
it's
the
hard,
zoo, right?
Because, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, oof. And like, yeah, oh awful. God, what if that? What, you think that'll be in the new miniseries?
I don't think so.
I hope not.
Yeah,
but yeah, I have it's a bit of a love and hate relationship with this part of the miniseries because there's some really poignant moments that stick out to me that I really am like, yeah, I really like that. Like Nick and Tom's relationships, like True Blue, I threw that in there for you, Randall. And I love Larry and the Judge, but it's only because it reminds me of their relationship in the book. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? So it's like, even though we only get that one scene, it's like, to me, it's like everything. I'm like, yes, but it reminds me of, well, we didn't have enough of this. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I it's a little back and forth. I think I'm bringing a nostalgia to it as well. Mm-hmm. So for me, it works on a level. I don't think it's going to work for folks just watching the miniseries on its own.
Yeah,
I agree.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because Harold's like my favorite character, and this is his. Well, I would, as I've made clear on the pod, I'm not a huge fan of his. Hey, look, love Corin Nemec as Parker Lewis. Don't love him as Harold Lauder. So it's just funny because he's my favorite character in the book, and this is the most play he gets throughout the whole miniseries, but it's also my least favorite part. And I think it's just because there's sort of fundamental mishandling of, in my opinion, of Nadine's storyline, of Harold's storyline, and then also of just the general free zone. What
you know, we didn't mention this, and I want to mention it just because I think this is one effective part of Nadine and Harold. It's when they pause and they go like, hey, Nadine, we're damned. Like, that's a great moment. And it really does kind of key into like King's stuff. And it's just like this little glimpse. But then it's so like, it's just that's what it is. It's just a glimpse.
It's a simple moment. I agree. That is a great moment. I remember I especially loved it when I was young. And but yeah, it's like those moments are too few and far between. Yeah. And so, yeah, it's like I just think especially the more I get older. And you know, once the miniseries, the new miniseries drops, I'm planning on writing a piece about sort of the opposing ideas of good and evil and how they manifest in the book and then in the miniseries as well. And because to me, it's really fascinating and it does speak to the general idea of, you know, especially from when you approach it from a Christian mindset versus when you approach it from like an agnostic mindset. And it's there's interesting nuance there. And I know we touched on it a lot in our book episodes on it, but you know, it's like, those are super interesting ideas to me. And I think they're rendered. And that's the thing is, Mac, you're not wrong when you say they only had 6 hours, you know, Yeah. It is hard to capture that nuance in that amount of time, and it is easier to just frame it as good and evil. And obviously, especially on network TV in the 90s, in the early 90s, it's like, you know, Christian sort of mindsets and things like that were very much the prevailing idea of what was good and sort of the broad societal level. And so it really does resonate that way sometimes, from the music to the general, you know, cinematography to the overwhelming whiteness of it all too, which, you know, I'm with you, Mike, like that's not something, you know, when we're talking about art from another period, that's not something that I, you know, I'm usually jumping to point out, but here it does feel pointed, especially mm-hmm. when there's only like 2 black people that we see in the entire thing. So it's like, it's really bizarre. And so I don't know. It's like, I always will have a fondness and an affection, as I've been saying in these episodes, for The Stand. But yeah, this one's rough, and the next one is sloppy and interesting. So I'm looking forward to that. it's going to be crazy. So, and we'll be back with that episode, part 4, in 2 weeks. Next week, we're going to be wrapping up our 2-part series on Golden Years, the 1991 series. And it's going to be the same crew, right? Jen, you're going to join us for part 2?
Yeah.
Cool. That'll be fun.
Thank God.
We had a very spirited discussion about part 1, and man, it is something. So that'll be fun. So that's next week. That's going to be a free episode for everyone. This has been a Patreon exclusive episode. So if you're listening, thank you for being a Patreon, giving us a donation. We appreciate it. It is. We are humbled by the amount that of people that have, you know, chosen to support us in this time, especially this time. And yeah, so we'll be back with more minisodes and also our part 4 in 2 weeks. So, so I think that's everything. This was fun. Jen, thanks for hopping on with us. Mac, Mike,
yeah, thanks for having me.
A pleasure as always.
Hey, I'm just glad
you
for
having
here.
Us on.
Yeah, this is fun. I think let's say goodbye. Long days.
And pleasant.
I got some hot friends. 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 But you know you want somebody to treat you good.
Murder in America is a true crime podcast that covers stories from all 50 states, including stories of mass shootings, serial killers, and lesser-known murders. Do you find yourself doing more research after listening to a true crime show? Well, Courtney and I used to do the same thing, and that's why we created Murder in America. Our podcast dives deep into each case. Our storytelling will make you feel like you're right there within the case with us, watching it all play out, and we do not shy away from the graphic details. If you're a fan of true crime, then listen to Murder in America on Spotify now.
Every town has its dark history. Hometown Ghost Stories is a paranormal podcast that goes town to town all across the globe, exploring the world's most haunted places, tapping into the dusty archives and the darkest corners to bring you the most terrifying stories of real people and their harrowing experiences. Hometown Ghost Stories dives into the history of haunted locations and investigates why and how these places earned their terrifying reputation. Rob, Dave, and Jesse go live every Tuesday night after an uninterrupted documentary-style breakdown on the case, followed by an open discussion with live viewers. Subscribe today to listen to Hometown Ghost Stories on your preferred podcast platform, or watch the video version on YouTube and now Spotify. Head on over to the Bloody FM Podcast Network and check out Hometown Ghost Stories, if you're brave enough.